Thank you.
Excellent.
I did enough sharing, so I don't have to do that. Okay. This paper is on the impact of years of experience on perceived contraindications and barriers to the use of LARC. And I think a number of you in this room, because we represent an age gradient, can recall the historical events related to LARC. And the, I don't know comments, I don't see your old friends, I just say that you're dear friends. But clearly, these events that occurred in the 70s and 80s continue to have a chilling effect on what is going on in our provision today. And we know that there were really many complications, including septic maternal deaths, PID, complications, recalls, and bankruptcy, lawsuits, withdrawals from this from the market. And this had a chilling effect. Even though it was focused on Dalkin Shield, it made a real impact on the availability of other IUDs in the field, and also the withdrawal of Norplan in the field. So all of these were really challenges that we've had a long time to overcome. And one of the questions that was really driving part of this evaluation is, how strong is this cohort effect? How strong is it for individuals who lived during these eras or now more recently? And have we closed some of those challenges that continue to infiltrate the field? So that's the framing for what we're trying to do with this part of our study. We still know and we still recognize that much of what goes on in the clinics has to do with trainers, training levels, the provider level of comfort, and still some concerns about litigation. So in the study, we're now taking a snapshot of 95 providers in the year 2012 who represent mostly Title X clinics from Colorado and Iowa, and they're part of this larger evaluation that I commented on earlier. And we've conducted our analysis by years since these professionals were licensed for being able to provide care. And we broke that up into three groups. A group that had less than 9 or up to 9 years, a group between 10 and 19, and a group that's over 20 years since they received the training. And we examined these patterns and significance around the type of training they got, their comfort level, their perception of barriers for various groups of women. Again, using those profiles and using different kinds of women and how would they respond. So overall, our sample indicated that as part of their clinical training, they actually did receive training in IUD insertion. So you can see that we are making some progress in terms of the younger cohort. And the implant insertion is now at a 74% level. But again, implant is one of the most recent methods. So this gap could represent more of the time in which the method came out and the type of training that people received. And over time, we anticipate that that will increase. So clearly, people who had been out in the field for longer periods of time did not receive that kind of training as part of their formal programs. We also asked them about their comfort level in terms of inserting each of these methods. And not surprisingly, the ones who have gotten the training most recently, for example, around Implanon, indicate that they're more comfortable, 86% versus those who are more experienced, longer out since they were licensed. We're at 75%. Paragard and Morena was also higher for more recent. But the one column I want to point out to you is this middle column. So while people in the past, when the IUDs were still available and they hadn't been withdrawn, got the training, it's the group in the middle children, that really got hit by the fact that the IUDs were not as readily available and that were not part of the training. So many individuals now in medical schools are working really hard and through professional associations like Wayne's and ACOG to truly try to turn this around. There were also concerns. We asked them about fears of uterine perforation. And you can see again that the group in the middle had the greatest fears, But that continues to be a concern even among more recent grads. There was also a concern about this history of the Dalkin Shield, and it's interesting that from a historical perspective, even the younger groups are affected by the chilling effect of the Dalkin Shield, and it's fairly consistent across groups. But interestingly enough, when we ask them about how concerned are you about lawsuits, it's that group that was living that history that expresses the concerns, and that's at 14% across these different methods of contraception as compared to the younger age or younger licensing histories. So when we ask them by these different cohorts, what do you think about the suitability of the LARC for these different kinds of patients, we found that there was tremendous agreement, and it was very positive to see the level of agreement around the utility for example, for patients with diabetes, or young adults, or unmarried women, or nulliparous women. But we did see also that Implanon was judged to be suitable and safe for teenagers and women with fibroids. However, in these profiles, we did see some differences, and I'll now give you some more data on this, but I thought we should at least give you the big picture of the kinds of profiles of different patients and clients coming to the clinics and the providers' kind of decision-making that goes through their minds about, well, should I give a LARC to someone who's had a history of a PID or a history of infertility or this whole issue of immediate post-abortion? So I want to, because I want to have more opportunities for questions, the next three slides are by method of LARC to show you a bit of the variation by the period of time in which people were licensed. So you can see that the history of STIs in the last 2 years, as well as the nulliparous women, was found to be statistically significant. And I do want to say and admit that or acknowledge that part of our challenge is that we have a relatively small sample. So the sample size would be larger, perhaps some of these other indicators would reach statistical significance. So we find here a big difference between the more recent graduates in terms of their perspective to teenagers ages 15 to 19 and the suitability of Paragard for them as compared to the ones who graduated over 20 years ago. But again, it's not statistically significant, but there's a pattern there that we should be immediately concerned about. For Mirena, we find that the history of ectopic pregnancy was significant at the 0.01 level, with much more recent trained individuals to be supportive of LARCs for individuals with a history of ectopic pregnancy. And then for Implanon, the patterns here show that there's a very strong support for a variety of these women, but also some variation, for example, with immediate post-abortion, there's still some variation, and again, and surprisingly, the younger the graduate, the less understanding that they have about the appropriateness. So overall, 64% of these comparisons by years since licensure indicated that those with licenses for the longest period of time were the least likely to believe that these methods were suitable and safe for various groups of women. Those with longer licensure were significantly less sure about the suitability and safety for women with a history of ectopic pregnancy or dysmenorrhea. And for the youngest graduates, they were significantly less likely to believe that Paragard and Mirena were suitable and safe for immediate post-abortion insertion. So clearly there's opportunities for training. So there are differences by years of licensure for 13 of these 20 subgroups of women. For 11 of the 20 groups, these older clinicians were least likely to approve Mirena, and they were not so disapproving of Implanon. It would appear that women then seeking LARC should be aware that the clinicians are not unanimous on the best practices in dispensing these methods, and they have a variety of points of view depending on their years in practice and probably depending upon where they were trained, and different perspectives on who are the best candidates for a LARC. And the mixed histories of these methods in earlier decades may have really still continued to have a chilling effect. And so as we do our training, as we do continuing education training, we need to be thinking about what segments of the population that we are training could be taking advantage of understanding different kinds of evidence and research to be able to feel more comfortable about their practices. So thank you very much.
Okay, I'm sure you have your questions scribbled, and I'd like to invite anyone who has a question to please raise your hand and speak clearly, and I'm going to take the moderator's privilege and ask the first one, I hope you don't mind. Just quickly, I was curious, Claire, do you have any sense of, after you gave this data about concerns among providers about the cloud of duck on shield, how that 20% level concern might compare to the general public's general concern about the cloud? Is there any comparative data?
That's a really good question. Maybe some other people who are doing it, but we...
Anybody else? Larry, do you know? Good to see you, by the way. Okay, so that's a question, to be unanswered. Maybe that's a research question.
Can I just modify? I do feel that a lot of the concerns are when women say they're concerned about the insertion, or they're concerned about pain, or they're concerned about side effects. That even though it may not say DALC and SHIELD, I think that some of those concerns may still be there, but it's contrary.
So that might be a good thing to parse out. Phil, did you have a...
Yes, as an old friend of Claire's, an old practitioner, I don't find that younger women remember much about the history unless their aunt or grandmother took the trouble to tell them about a bad experience with DALC and SHIELD. Mm-hmm. So I think we're beyond the generation of women who are concerned about the infertility effects.
That's my perception too, but so I was just looking at the challenge of breaking the myth with our own provider community when the general audience may not have the same. Please, in the back.
But I think the choice project in St. Louis showed that it is not really a problem or a design. So if they have access, no financial barriers, and can and are educated on it, they are using it. So it doesn't seem that they are likely that there is some kind of stigma barrier or concern of among the clients.
That's great. So for those of us enlightened folks in this room, we'll have to work on those providers. Another question, please. Oh, good. Great. And will that be at this meeting next year? That would be great. Maybe. That's good. Questions, please. Phil. Yes, say who you are, but please, everyone, and ask your question.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Phil's asking why in Richard's study and Bixby's study was it that the women who were not born in California, actually most likely Mexico, had a better outcome in terms of having better spacing in their with their children, right? That's the question.
Everyone, please identify yourself and start writing.
Speak up.
Mary Mims, I'm one of the people who worked on this project with Richard, and we are puzzling over that question. There's limited information to answer that, and we've done have claims data from Medi-Cal and Genentech where you can guess wildly about what happened in a particular visit.
Mary, I'm not going to speculate.
Okay. Well, I'll speculate briefly.
I don't think there's someone in the back.
No,
you want to talk to speculate?
Okay. The only speculation I can offer, Phil, is the fact that many of these women who are immigrants and have a child are really highly motivated to, as immigrants, to make money. So having a second child within a very short period of time may defeat them from being able to fulfill their dreams of immigration. And I'm not sure if that's too simplistic, or whether they've had other children, you know, and they're changing their family size formulation, but I think my sense is that it may have to do with some of their economics. And I don't know if Richard wants to conjure as well, but then...
I think, Richard, let's hear from you. While we're speculating. Yeah, I mean, I would think that has... It's like the cultural influence that affects, like, how they're planning their pregnancies at birth.
Second, also let me speculate instead of Richard.
Please identify yourself.
So I'm Heike-Thiele Bockenegger, the second author of this of Richard's study. So one other reason may be that a large number of foreign-born a group of the foreign-born may be fairly undocumented. So they are losing medical after a certain period, and then they are seen by family members, which here in California we provide services to. Especially to undocumented women. And Family Pack is providing counseling, and it's really like designed to provide family planning services. So if we saw an effect as well, a significant effect of Family Pack in this study. So it may be that women are more likely than once they are going to Family Pack, they are more likely to have continuous contraceptive coverage and hence as well optimal pregnancy intervals, and a large number of Latina foreign-born who are undocumented would fall into that category. Whereas a lot of US-born women, once they have their child, are now qualifying for Medicaid and then continue to be seen by Medicaid. This as well is speculation, it's not kind of completely confirmed because we didn't do all the 150 data runs we need to really make a solid statement on
that.
And who asked that question? Speak up, Joe.
I mean, women as well are more likely to sign up for IUDs. I don't think we checked specifically whether women in the fourth part, like after the index was, they're more likely to be Latinas to work in the IUDs. I don't think we did
that. It's fun to speculate, isn't it? Let's do a little more here. Identify yourself, please. I sense a research proposal being developed at this point in this room. I'm sure there's some funders who might want to help support that. Any other speculation before we move on to the next question? Joe?
No, I'm
going
to move on to the next
question. Okay, let's go. I have someone else in the back who had their hand up first, so please identify yourself. Everybody hear the question?
Sure. Yes, there are challenges. There were certainly challenges at the get-go. When I was brought in, I came from Atlanta, and I was told, you're here to be the teen pregnancy prevention coordinator, and within about 2 weeks, they're like, oh, and by the way, we think it would work better under infant mortality. I myself had a moment where I was like, like that doesn't make sense. And I had to take a moment and realign what our goals were with the limited resources. I think some of the biggest challenges we faced were among the infant mortality reduction group, there was the idea that every baby's wanted. You know, every baby is valuable, which we also felt in looking pregnancy risk prevention, and this was very anecdotal, but we faced that side of the partnership for the infant mortality reduction, whereas teen pregnancy prevention, one of our key partners for both these projects is Planned Parenthood of Maryland, and how they participated in those two different groups was very different. So one was improving birth outcomes. The Planned Parenthood had this idea about their role for infant mortality reduction was about interpartum safety. They really saw that role. But with teen pregnancy prevention, they were more direct with how they felt about being involved. And one of the taglines, I can think very vividly of one of the biggest points of contention we had over the couple of years, is that the tagline for Be More for Healthy Babies, every baby counts on you, which is a great tagline. I mean, it was very marketable, it tested well, except some of the folks thought that that wasn't really aligning with how teen pregnancy prevention was, that every baby doesn't count on you because our teens are our kids. You know, don't tell them that the kid is counting on them when we should be talking about prevention. And I'm not sure if that's well articulated, but we did face a lot of challenges. We faced the school system, which is fun anywhere. you know, teen pregnancy prevention in Baltimore has traditionally been a limited education model. There are some school-based health centers. None are currently providing long-acting reversible contraceptives as they used to. And times changed. And the school system is a great partner for both of these initiatives in providing parental support as well as parental messaging and referral for contraceptives. But it wasn't easy to get them to see the alignment of these two things. I think cute, you know, little babies are like cute, and it was really easy for them to go around for Be More for Healthy Babies and find partners and just say, look at the cute baby. And teen pregnancy prevention requires people in Baltimore to acknowledge that teenagers are having sex, and that's not easy. Mm-hmm. So it was really challenging, but I do think after 2 years... Mm-hmm.
Good job bringing people together who wouldn't necessarily come together. And I would ask you, is also limited resources, is that a factor?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I think Baltimore. So, too. That's my bias. But it really does motivate folks, doesn't it, to work together. Excellent. So, Joe, you're on the floor.
About do we differentiate between surgical and medical abortion? Is that what you're saying? I don't think we looked. I have to say honestly that I don't think we differentiated that item between the two types of abortion. But that's an interesting question that you've raised. Is there something in the history or in the research you've done, Joe? So right as you're getting... Well, it'd be interesting, especially if there would be a financial incentive for the provider to do that. Because I think that still is an issue in another study that... I think, Antonio, is that part of your poster today? About the numbers of visits that people, do you want to comment?
Yeah,
why don't you stand up?
Please stand up, state your name and speak up.
I was asking about repeat visits to get...
So actually, looking at the clinician data, that
So we have time for two more questions, and I'd really like to get them. Who had their hand up? I saw a hand in the back, or either.
I have whether it's a financial incentive, I'm sure some stuff is going to be our data from the only way someone can get a medication right now, long acting together, is one thing they would go to the counters. Some people figure out how to do that. It's legal, but a lot of people have to figure out how to do that.
That would be a good lesson. I have one last question for, thank you, Kirsten. One last question for Richard, and this is a totally dumb question on my part. I don't know the basics, so how does one come up with the idea that 18 months is the optimal window? How do we know?
Previous literature, we were finding that, like, the optimal interval generally is 18 to 23 months.
Yeah.
So, like, for our studies, we were just doing
the... You just picked it, okay.
Yeah, just from literature.
All right. That's great. One more question, please, in the front.
Healthy People 2020 as well.
Thank you.
It's WHO. Yeah.
WHO, great. Thank you. That's how dumb I'm being.
A comment just on the panel. I think it kind of, a lot of stuff we're doing, especially with the Food Monitor Institute, if someone who's not, who doesn't work on transplant or reproductive health, then your information is very helpful for me. And with the teams that, you know, Regina Orders and I work a little bit, we often use the shorts that you have to explain the importance of transplant and reproductive health. And so I think that's, you know, as you go through and see how the use is increasing, it's the importance of clearly communicating that to people and making sure that there's access to the internet, a lot of through the web. But I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Guttmacher folks. You do great work, and the field values your work. One last question? Anyone? Okay, we've gone 1 minute over, but I want to say this was a great session. I really enjoyed it. Please give the panel applause. You did fantastic.